And now we turn to the second quarter equity market review. And in a moment, I'm going to bring in Chuck Gibson, who is someone who needs no introduction on the Solaria report. He's the managing member of Financial Perspectives in Pleasanton, California. That's the San Francisco Bay Area. And he's also managing member and my partner at C-Lane Advisory. If you're not familiar with Chuck's work, check out our equity market library. There's great analysis on equity markets in previous quarters. Chuck has outdone himself today. There are big questions facing us in the economy and in the world and the market, and they play out as you watch the equity markets, and we're going to be talking about them today. And Chuck has made some fantastic charts. You'll be following them on Instant Teleseminar. If for any reason you can't, they'll be up on the blog. We've decided to pre-record because the transcript has been so useful to so many of our subscribers, and we wanted to make sure we could get the transcript out much faster with pictures of the charts. So we're pre-recording, and then after we play the pre-recording, Chuck and I will be taking questions live. So we're glad you're joining for this. We're glad you're joining us today for this. As I said before, there are very big questions before us, and so we have some enormous ground to cover. Chuck, are you with us?
I am.
Okay. Well, let's dive right in. It's been a very exciting quarter. It's an exciting time to be an investment advisor, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. it has been challenging. There's no question.
So how'd we do? Tell us about the first quarter. What happened?
Well, let's pull up chart number one and take a look at that first. So as you can see, all major U.S. stock markets, the Dow, the S&P 500, and the Russell Small Caps, had banner quarters. All experienced double-digit gains. EAFE, which is Europe, Far East, Australia, Asia, had a good quarter. It was up 3.7%. While the emerging markets were down almost the same amount EAFE was up. The U.S. aggregate bond index was essentially flat, while junk bonds, in this era of investors looking for yield, kept chugging along, rising 2%. And what has been a common theme of late, unfortunately, precious metals took it on the chin. Gold was down 3.7%, and silver lost 4.4%.
Right, and this is a significant divergence of precious metals from the equity markets. So we're really seeing commodities not trading like the other risk assets. We're really seeing a divergence.
Yeah, and we're going to bring that up in a little detail further down as we get into that. But that is one of the things that's been, I won't say it's bothering you, but we're watching it real closely.
Right.
You want to go to chart number two?
Yes.
All right. So if we look at chart two, here we're going to drill down to the sector level. And we could see that healthcare, utilities, consumer cyclicals, and staples were the clear winners. They were all up over 2%, while the industrials, energy, and financials all posted smaller gains. But interestingly, you've got technology materials which lagged big time with pretty large losses.
I have to tell you, when I first saw this chart, it stunned me. First of all, because if you look at the different sectors, and this is because of the way the analysis is calculated, no sector did as well as the overall market. But more importantly, if you look at the things that really give an economy muscle, that really speak to the economy getting stronger, they're down. And the things that are deeply dependent on government subsidy because there's inelastic demand, the prices can get rolled through to consumers, we're doing well. So when I looked at this chart, it surprised me because it maps out a picture of an economy that is not as strong as we're certainly hearing in the corporate media.
Yeah, so my thoughts immediately, and we're going to talk about this a little bit further down too, but I immediately question, is this just, you know, a one-time quarterly anomaly, or is this the new mode that we're in?
I pray it's just an anomaly.
Yes. All right, let's go on to chart number three if you're ready.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a lot of data here, but what we're looking at in the first column is a listing of all the world's stock markets. And the second column is their first quarter returns. And the final, the third column there, shows the three-year performance. And I'll kind of summarize this for you because there's a lot of things to look at. But Venezuela, Japan, Argentina, and the Philippines were the top performers, and they all gained more than 17%, which, you know, for a quarter, that's huge.
Right.
And we've got the Czech Republic, Italy, Egypt, Poland, and Russia bringing up the rear, and they all lost about 4%. So
right,
the market
most... Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was going to say the markets in general were, all of the markets around the world had pretty good quarters in terms of gains.
Right, it's quite remarkable.
Yeah. All right. You want to go to chart number 4?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So this is a chart that shows the major world markets and how they've fared since the 2009 crisis. And you can see from the top right legend there that the U.S., India, and Hong Kong have all doubled in price. And the Chinese stocks, which have been the worst performer, were still up an impressive 64% since then.
Right.
And the bottom right legend shows how far away each of the markets are from their all-time highs. And as of the date of this chart, it was the U.S. markets that were the only ones to have made a new high. I think since then, last week, England's FTSE hit a new high.
Right, but essentially, you know, I look at these numbers, and to me, they're flat. In other words, they're flat from their high. All we've done is get back to where we were, you know. So if you certainly look at them from the bottom in 2009, they look much better than if you look at them from the last high.
Yeah, they're quite impressive. The other thing is, and I know what, you know, we've had this discussion before, what would they look like if you did it on a, you know, an inflation-based adjustment?
Right. Right, so we should explain what that means. So when we look at an index in any market, we're generally looking at a nominal value. And so if the value of the currency that it's priced in diminishes over time, it can look like things are going up when, in fact, your purchasing power is going down.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think the problem with, you know, we always have when you try and look at that view and try and present that, you have two variables. One is the amount that the index actually rises, and then you also have what you have to divide by, which is the index to inflation. And that's where the problem comes in, because do you use, you know, the governments, or do you use something that's more realistic?
Right.
So it makes it very difficult to you know, do that calculation, because one tends to, if you use the government, one tends to just ignore it and say it's not real because we don't believe the data that's being presented to us.
One of the index, looking at equity markets indexes always makes me nervous, because there can be so much going on inside of it. You know, you're always hearing me say there's a new world being born and there's a new world dying. You know, and you're getting an average of both of those things. And that's why I like to, you know, the charts that help me look inside and see the different sectors and what's going on inside the big Cuisinart average.
Well, that actually leads me into the next section, which is, you know, I do the same thing, as you know, and kind of trying to look at the market and see what's going on. And there's three things that really jumped out at me in this last quarter, and you know, they're oddities. And so what I'm going to do is present them here. And so let's take a look at chart number 5. And this first oddity is really the divergence between stocks and commodities. So if you look at the chart, it goes back to the top of 2008 before the market started selling off hard. And the black line for reference is the S&P 500. The gold line is copper. And the purple line represents a commodity index. And in that commodity index are 19 physical commodity futures, so they're futures contracts. And those components consist of things within energy, metals, grains, livestock, and things called the soft commodities, which are things like orange juice and coffee. So it's really supposed to represent a basket of commodities.
Right.
So if you look at recent history, and this is what I'm talking about, is from the 2008 level, it's shown that both copper and commodities have tracked pretty well against the S&P. You know, they don't necessarily move the same amount, but they have been moving in the same direction.
Right.
And so what you see from the chart is that sometime mid last year, about the time the market really took off on a tear, both commodities and coppers decoupled with the stock market. Since then, they've moved sideways while stocks have, you know, pushed strongly higher. And here's the thing. This is the part that's the oddity. Commodities, and especially copper, are viewed as proxies to the strength of an economy. And the stock market is telling us that the economy is doing very well, at least well enough to return record profits. Yet commodities aren't buying into the story.
Right.
So if the economy is strong enough to lift equities to new highs, why aren't copper and commodities following along? Somebody has to be wrong. And it's either stocks need to fall or commodities and copper need to catch up. So I hate to say this, you know, maybe this is a new paradigm where we're decoupling for some extended period, because that's happened in the past. I don't know, but this is something that, you know, I continue to follow closely.
Right. This is one of the reasons I think that the budget talks, both in Europe and here, are so sensitive, because if you look at the sectors that are doing well, they're directly or indirectly dependent on a lot of government subsidy. And so, you know, to me, that's going to be, there's going to be even more pressure on the legislators, both here and in Europe, because the markets are going to be much more dependent on those cash flows.
Exactly. Well, that leads me to the next section, which is the sector analysis anomaly. Let's go to chart number 6. And this is the same chart I showed above, but, you know, I wanted to drill down into the details a little bit. So what we saw this past quarter was a rotation out of those more aggressive sectors that took us to historic highs, like technology, and into the more defensive sectors.
Right.
So, you know, is the market picking up on something here that's important on the horizon, or is this just, I don't know, a rotational breather waiting for the next leg up? So,
right.
I don't know what it is, but don't get me wrong. The daily charts for the U.S. broad market indexes remain intact and still very bullishly configured. But this divergence is just reinforcing my cautious short-term position here.
Right.
And, you know, there's no question going forward that these defensive sectors can still, you know, push this market higher.
Right.
But if there's anything I've learned in my market studies and experience, is that towards the end of a bull market, it's almost always the case that the defensive sectors are what tend to lead.
Right.
So I want to show another or some more support of that argument if we move to chart number 7. All right. So, you know, this chart is a little bit busy, but it does help confirm the concerns that I raised just above. So last quarter, we talked about the long-term economic secular cycles. And the data in this chart is based upon the known shorter-term four-year economic and stock market cycles. So at the top of the chart, there are different market sectors up there listed, such as technology, industrials, energy, healthcare, etc. Below them are two sets of cycles representing the stock market cycle, which is in red, and the economic cycle in green. So let's actually use this chart in today as an example. So if you remember what our leading sectors were last quarter, they were healthcare, consumer staples, and utilities. Now let's find those sectors at the top of the chart. And what you see is they're over there up on the right-hand side. They're all bunched together. Now draw an imaginary line from where they're, you know, where that intersection is, and follow it straight down to where it intersects the red and green cycles. So if you look, the economic cycle tells us we have made a full recovery and we are in the early stages of a recession. The stock market cycle says we have topped out and we should be at the beginning stages of a bear market. So this is, you know, one more reason for, you know, our cautious short-term equity stance.
Right.
All right. So let's just jump right into the final and third anomaly, which is taking a look at the global markets. Chart number 8. So here I've listed the top 13 largest global stock markets and their returns over the first quarter of 2013. And I have them ranked in order of quarterly gain. So as you can see, I've divided them up and they kind of neatly fit into three sections. The top group had a stellar first quarter. The second tier, while up moderately, lagged the top five. And then finally bringing up the rear, the final tier, they all had negative returns. So let's drill down one more level and take a look at the top five. So in the top group, I have listed five markets, but there's really only three there because three of the five are U.S. markets. There are the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ. So I just count that as one. And the one that stands out in that list is that it's the Japanese stock market. It had almost a 20% gain for the first quarter. And below the Nikkei comes in the three major U.S. indices, and then split by the London FTSE. So if you notice, all of these markets are nations which have two things in common. They have full control over their central banks, which in turn control both interest rates and currency creation. And all of these banks are at presently involved in huge money printing efforts via quantitative easing. Additionally, you know, they are all promising or continue to increase their efforts in printing. And this money has to go somewhere, and it makes sense that at least some portion of it is going to find a home in the stock markets.
Right.
So let's look at the middle group. This group consists mostly from the core of Europe. The one exception, of course, is Canada. But Canada, like the European nations, has not yet embarked on outright quantitative easing. As such, none of these country stock markets are really in bubble territory, and much, you know, unlike the first group.
Right.
And then Germany and Holland, in particular, are attempting the impossible. They're trying to impose fiscal and financial discipline in the EU countries with no control over their governments or their taxpayers. And they're showing the discipline while most of the rest of Europe is not doing so much. And then finally, let's close out the discussion with the bottom tier. And you'll notice how all of these countries come from Asia. And the contrast between these four in this bottom and Japan, which is in the top list, in my mind, could hardly be greater. While the Japanese market was up almost 20% for the first 3 months, all the countries in the bottom group had negative returns. And to me, this is just a great example of the dislocation of real versus paper, of construction versus consumption, of massive debt versus fiscal management, and of a dying middle class versus a structurally positive demographics.
So the more financially and economically responsible you were, the worse you did.
Unfortunately, that's exactly the way it looks, at least for Q1.
Right.
So, you know, I'm going to automatically say, who said that there's no, you know, there's no value in printing money?
Right. Right.
This is why it baffles me. All right. Well, let's move on to the final chart in section one of the agenda here. And, you know, this is one that I know you like, and this is.
I love this chart. I was surprised. This chart really surprised me.
Yeah. Well, you know, you tell me what you see in this thing.
Well, the thing that surprised me was I had thought that the growth of the government bond sector was greater than it showed it to be relative to the other sectors. So I maybe we should why don't we first go through and explain what this chart is before we start discussing it?
Okay, well this is the Dow Jones performance during the reelected presidential second terms.
Uh-huh.
And so what it shows by president, it shows how the stock performance, how the stock market did during their second term, split out by their first year, their second year, their third year, and their final year, and then it takes a look at the entire, during their entire term of the second term.
Uh-huh.
And what I find interesting is that, you know, on average, the first year performance of the market was down 3.8% on average, but the thing was is that ever since Reagan, there's never been a down year. Well, all those down years happened prior to Reagan, and anything since Reagan has been positive in the first year.
That is fascinating. I can't come up with a politically logical explanation.
Well, neither can I. I thought it was going to be, you know, I thought from what I read, you know, before I actually looked at the data, I saw that it was negative. And it kind of makes sense the first year you're going to have a down year. But, you know, it's clearly not consistently negative, and it hasn't been negative since Nixon. So, you know.
Although I will say this, if you look at the internal financial controls within the federal government, they've been steadily deteriorating. And the Reagan administration was very instrumental in weakening them. But the subsequent administrations were as well. So, you know, that is one possible contributor, but I can't imagine it's everything.
Well, it was, you know, again, a shock to me. I'm not sure I could draw a firm conclusion from it, but it was interesting.
The thing, you know, and I'll bring this up as we look at the other charts. The thing that I said that there are a lot of big questions as to which way things go. And to me, one of the big questions is for five or more decades, since World War II, we've had the federal government borrow and spend, borrow and spend, borrow and spend. And that money is spilled over into all sectors, but certainly into corporate profits one way or another. And then for two decades, we've had very liberal monetary policy, and that money spilled over. And the question is, if those policies have to change, and certainly fiscally, I think the fiscal policies do have to change, how's that going to spill back over? Because it's been such a big platform for all the markets, bond and equities. What happens when that platform gets re-engineered? And I think, you know, most of the market participants who are functioning have been functioning on that platform so long, they think it's sort of natural. You know, the sun comes up and all this money's around. I don't think anybody's ready for the paradigm shift, frankly.
Well, and I know that wasn't where we wanted to go with this discussion, but I you know, my question to you would be is that because of that, what is the probability of that happening?
Well, let me jump back to the chart before this, where we looked at the three markets or the three basket of markets.
Yeah.
So you're looking at markets which are being the top markets that are doing so well are literally reflecting an addiction to central bank money and treasury money. Okay, the basket at the bottom, South Korea, Shanghai, Hong Kong, India, are used to struggling without these massive infusions of financial methadone. And what is happening, you know, so we see this bifurcation, we can see the pressures. If you're a government leader and you can get these kind of results in the financial market by injecting another round of that financial methadone, the pressure on you to do it is enormous. I mean, at some point it becomes impossible not to. But what we're facing as a society is as follows. You know, think of all the financial assets as an upside down pyramid sitting on top of the different governmental budgets. We've now created this tornado of derivatives and bonds and stocks, which need their next hit, or else they're going to have to adjust. And the challenge with that is we're running the economy to keep the value of the paper up instead of running the economy to build the most economic muscle over the long term. You know, part of it is a short term and long term. And the question is a matter of processes. How do you create a political process that will allow you to build a strong economy as opposed to keep a speculative paper game going? And there needs to be a reconciliation between our securitization of the world and the real world. And that's why, you know, when you listen to you and I, we keep talking about fundamentals and tangibles, because at some point, you know, if you strip your real economy to keep the paper game going, we all know where that goes. And that's one of the big questions you and I keep asking. How do we make sure that you know, are the people that we're responsible to serve are protected in that transition? Because it's one way or another, it's happening.
Yeah, and it's been painful because if you look at the laggards, it's all been about the things that we think are going to be going, you know, what's going to last through this. It's going to be those tangibles, those real things that are going to survive. And unfortunately, of late, it's been just the opposite.
Well, to me, what a savvy investor can do is if you're interested in investing in the fundamentals, we know in all of these economies, there are really great companies. You know, and you're the one who introduced me to your concept of gems. And we struggle with, you know, how do you describe what a gem is? And it's one of those things where you know it when you see it. But within all these different sectors, there are companies that are real gems that are really coming up with solutions for, you know, or the things we need to build the future. And I think if you're a savvy investor, what you can do is not swing around like a fruit fly with the money printing, but really focus on where are those gems? Because, you know, I'm always saying, you know, there's one surgical system company I'm always using as an example, that from 2003 to, I think it was 2012, silver was up 800%, gold was up 500%, and the surgical system company was up 4,200%. So, I think... sometimes when these kinds of anomalies happen between what's real and what's not, if you can focus on what's real, you can find those gems and take advantage of the fact that they're down.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
But well, you need a strong stomach.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It does test your mettle. There's no question.
Yeah.
All right. You want to jump right into the second part?
Yes, sir.
All righty. So, you know, for those that were familiar, last quarter we spent the second half of our discussion on the headwinds facing equities. So this quarter, in an attempt to be fair and balanced, because you know that's me, Mr. Fair and Balanced, I want to present the other side. Looking beyond the inherent volatility in equities, I strongly believe that they will be the best investment vehicle for the future, for those with long-term investment horizons. I see this only because of the fact that it will be companies and entrepreneurs or in individuals, not governments, that are going to provide the solutions for both human and our planetary needs. So if we're going to thrive and flourish, exactly what you just said, businesses will need to be front and center.
Right.
All right, let's jump right into chart number 10.
Uh-huh.
So this is an image of global, the McKinsey's tried to put their hands around the size of the global financial assets. So McKinsey did a study where they estimated the size of all global financial estimates, and they broke it down into six categories, which were from the top to the bottom there. You can see there were non-securitized loans, securitized loans, corporate bonds, financial sector bonds, government bonds, and equities. And as you can see in the adjacent table to the right, debt issuance has grown substantially in all the areas except for securitized loans, which have been essentially flat since 2007. And you notice that government bonds have increased the fastest, and they're in a virtual tie with corporate bonds, which I think they grew over a 9% per year compound annual growth rate. And what I find most interesting in all this data is that that same period of time, equities actually shrunk by more than 5% a year.
Right. Right. And this chart, if you look at our model for how we're functioning economically, this model is very scary because when people own equity in something, they have a vested interest in seeing it work. When they are swimming in government guarantees and government debt, you know, they don't care if it works. They think they're protected. And you know, I've said when Cyprus happened, we've really rung the bell on that model. It's a wake-up call that if the overall economy doesn't work, then maybe your government guarantees don't mean so much. So to me, we've got to get into some kind of equity model. We can't keep working. You know, we can't keep swimming in a sea of government debt. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Well, let's take a look at chart number 11. So for me, this was probably one of the most surprising sets of data, just because of the fact that, you know, in my ignorance, I assumed that most households around the world were going to hold financial assets similar to how we do here in the U.S. And in this chart, it's very clear that, you know, that they don't. And so real briefly, the blue line are the equities, and the light blue are cash and deposits, and the black portion are bonds, and then you've got loans, insurance, and others. So what you can see here is that the United States owns roughly 40%+ of their entire financial assets in equities, where the next closest one is approximately half of that, and everybody is much, much lower than that. So bottom line, for me, this was so surprising that all it's really going to take is for people to realize what you just said, and that is that, you know, the movement, it's going to take us a small movement into equities to be able to give a nice boost to the equity market going forward.
Right. It's a very big swing globally. If the U.S. holds where it is, and other countries, as they, particularly in the emerging markets, start to increase anywhere close to us, it's an enormous swing.
Yeah, and considering, I don't know if the trend is going to be the same, but you consider that equities have been declining, you know, at a 5% per year basis, that's going to create a supply and demand type of imbalance.
Right.
Okay, let's jump right into chart number 12. And this is a snapshot of total global debt as a percentage of GDP, and this was as of 2011. So in the upper half of the chart, it shows information on the world's 10 largest developed countries. And the bottom shows the worrisome pig countries. And as you can see, they've sliced the data up into smaller pieces, out by government debt, which is in blue, and then household debt there is in red, non-financial debt is in green, and finally financial institution debt is shown there in yellow. And to me, this was quite shocking when you look at it as a percentage of GDP, and I kind of it made me think, I'm not going to do it, but it made me think of a horse race, and, you know, here we've got Japan bringing up, you know, coming around the corner first, followed by United Kingdom, closely followed by Spain. And it just, this is amazing to me that the world is in this kind of situation.
Well, it's not so amazing to me, since I spent many decades struggling in the trenches of government service trying to, or government contracting trying to deal with it. But I would say it's unpleasant that we're here. And I think the thing that is scary about this chart is if you look at the unfunded liabilities, which are not included in these numbers, you know, essentially they reflect an aging population. And so the subscribers are always listening to me quote Neil Howe, who said, we have $100 trillion of unfunded liabilities. How's that supposed to work out? And so if you look at the debt levels now versus the debt levels, if we try and deal with those unfunded liabilities, you know, we're clearly coming into a major turn in all sorts of different policies and situations. And it's a pretty amazing situation to be in. And I think, as I said, they're big questions. And to me, this is one of the biggest questions. How do these unfunded liabilities get worked out? How do we go from having this much debt? I said the other night on the Salieri Report, we need a planetary debt for equity swap. And you kind of wonder how that's going to happen. And I go back to my favorite quote from Tina Turner. Are we going to do this nice or rough? It's going to happen one way or the other.
Yeah, it seems like you're using that quote more and more frequently.
Yes, I am.
All right, let's move on to chart number 13. You know, the last chart was one of, you know, just the largest developed countries. So let's, you know, I wanted to take a look at the world in perspective. And this chart, I think, is just, you know, it does give us a global perspective of the problem. So the countries that are in green are those countries with the lowest debt ratios, and the darker the green, the lower the rates. Those in red have the highest debt ratios, and of course the darker the red, the worse the problem. So, you know, please note though that this chart takes into account only public debt, whereas the other one was a little bit different, included a little bit more.
Right.
So there might be a little mismatch in the numbers.
Right. So what we see are we have economies with great long-term growth that have less debt.
Yes.
And then we have the mature economies that are slowing down and have tremendous amounts of debt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. You want to move to chart number 14?
This is one of my favorites.
Yeah. Favorite in a interesting way. You know, as it states on the header, this chart is one of the growth of U.S. federal debt since the year 2000 through 2011. And what I wanted to do by showing this data is really focus on the rate of growth, not necessarily the actual percentage. And while the debt percentages are astonishing, to me, what's more incredible is the rate of growth. So you could see there that in 2000, we started on this hockey stick style ramp. That should make anybody looking at this chart very queasy, I guess, unless you're a Fed member. And in which case, I did want to point out that for those who might be following very closely, that the reported numbers on this chart, again, might vary slightly from the other ones that are presented, and that's partially due to either different data sources and or time periods. But what we're trying to do is get the magnitude and the direction, not necessarily the exact numbers.
One of the things that struck me about this is if you look at the increase in the nominal amount of debt between 2000 and 2011, and you simply add up the amount of the increase, we had a study come out from Harvard. It was up on the blog about 2 weeks ago saying that the total cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were $4 to $6 trillion. So if you take the money that went missing in 2000, 2001, 2002, which is $4 trillion that we know of, you take the $4 to $6 trillion for Iraq and Afghanistan, and then you take the portion of the bailout that was on budget, that totals, that explains the entire increase. Now, what's also going on is you have tremendous pressure on employment and income, and therefore tax flows into the government at the same time. So what we know is whether it's the population that's aging or the sort of reengineering of global labor with globalization, you have this systemic deficit and more people in America. You know, I say if you come to any county, you just see a skyrocketing of household dependency on government subsidies. And that's a dynamic that can just shoot this line continually up, up, up. And I think for all of us looking at it, the question is, well, what's the end game? You know, how exactly is this supposed to work? And I did an article called Coming Clean Beyond the Fiscal Cliff at the beginning of the year so that people who are interested could really look a little bit deeper and see why the Congress has such a challenge ahead of them, because reconciling these different issues is... it's remember what we use this at C-Lane. The head of Luxembourg said, "We know what we need to do, we just don't know how to be reelected after we do it."
Yeah. Well, you know, not only in addition to what the end game is, it's just as important as when it's, you know, it's not just what, it's the when that's really hard and challenging for those that are investing. Because, you know, if it does turn out to anything close to where we all think it might end, it's really going to test the markets, I think.
Right. And I look at this chart, Chuck, and it is my nature to want to stick with primary trends.
Yeah.
So I see the kind of the excellence of the fundamentals in the emerging markets, and I say, you know, that's where I want to align. But then you get into a quarter where everything that is flying up in the stock market is something that when you look at this chart, you say, oh my God, the fundamentals are so dreadful. You know, it's scary to put money in it, let alone at these highs. You know, and yet sort of the worst fundamentals in the world are up 20% this quarter. I mean, how do you reconcile that? So the risk of going into those things when they're flying is much greater than I think it looks.
Yes. I think just helps us make the argument for why we're cautious at this point in time.
Right.
All right, let's take a look at chart number 15. And for those that
I call this chart the end of the world as we know it.
Well, this is it's a historical look at the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond pricing. And, you know, just from a cursory glance, it confirms that the U.S. Treasuries have been in one of the longest-running capital bull markets that we can think of. So, therefore, bond yields, which are the inverse of price, have, of course, been in one of the longest bear markets. So, just for a reference point, 30-year yields in 1981 were at 14%, and today they're just slightly above 3%.
Right.
So, what is clear, though, that, you know, this bull market is very long in the tooth, and as we all know, bulls and bears are eventually moved out to pasture where they eventually die. So the question to me is, and what I'd love to find out and figure out, is when will we see the first crack in rates appear? Because that is going to make because of the size of the bond market, is going to be a potential major shift.
Right, and I told you, you know my story in February. I was at Morningstar and discovered that the 6-month return on long treasury bond funds had been negative 7.6%.
Yeah.
You know, the treasury market had been under pressure. And if you're all the governments around the world trying to finance this enormous government debt, even just a little, you know, even a bad quarter or a bad 6 months, that's pretty scary because this entire tornado is dependent on the government budgets being able to borrow more money and send more money up the tornado. And so you've got this tiny little point that spreads out into this huge upside down pyramid. And if that starts to get shaky, you know, the whole pyramid gets shaky. And, one of my favorite quotes is James Carville saying, you know, when I die, I want to come back as the bond market. You can intimidate everybody. But what he meant was, you know, there are great stories at the beginning of the Clinton administration of Rubin as Secretary of Treasury, you know, killing every idea that everybody wanted to do, saying the bond market wouldn't like it. And that's because the whole game is so dependent on the bond market, and we've had winds in our sails the whole way. And I think for all of us, the question is, you know, if that turns around, what happens next? Because it's going to reverberate through every aspect of life and every financial market.
Yeah, and I think what people that really haven't, you know, been involved in the markets, regardless of which market, what you find is when you have panic, you have prices that move unbelievably fast. And all I have to do, again, it's not really a market, but just take a look at what Bitcoin did.
Right.
Down 70% in 2 days or whatever it was.
Right.
And so that's how people react when there's fear and they're afraid something's happening. And so while we're moving along down this path of, you know, ever-increasing bond prices and lower bond yields, all you do need is that one crack to be able to start the lemmings jumping off the cliff.
Well, I think I said that there are big questions before us. And I think one of the biggest questions that you and I struggle with is we've seen governments print more and more money, more and more money, more and more money, and that money's piling up in the bond market. And you watch the central banks and you think, how in the world can they keep all that money in the bond market when it's earning nothing? And you know, but they've done it, and it piles up and it piles up and it piles up. And the question is, it's like a herd of wild horses. If they decide to leave, where are they going to go? Because it's got to go someplace.
Yep.
You know, and it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, Bitcoin, $1 billion is nothing compared to the bond market. But it wouldn't surprise me if you had money saying, well, you know, I might as well go into Bitcoin.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I think the big question is that money going to go into the equity markets? Is that kind of money going to go into the commodity market? Is that money going to go in real estate? Where is it going to go? Because it's got to go someplace.
Right. Well, let's jump on to the next few charts, because that's exactly where, you know, I was leading with that one. And we don't know where it's going to go, but it definitely has, you know, it has you wondering, because it will, as you said, reverberate through all the markets.
Right.
So let's take a look at chart number 16, which is sovereign debt yields. And just for reference, because it's not shown there, last week the U.S. bond 10-year treasury hit a 1.72%. So as a matter of perspective, you can see from this chart that the United States is basically paying the going rate for 10-year sovereign sovereign debt as we sit smack dab in the middle of the other developed countries shown there. So, you know, as you were alluding to, I see this and I say, what's going on? If there's unprecedented printing of money and issuance of sovereign debt, then I automatically think that, you know, the laws of economics appear to be violated. Because,
right.
You know, as you'd expect prices, you would expect prices to fall, yields to rise under that scenario. And we learned that in beginning economics that when the supply of something gets larger and larger, the price is supposed to go down.
Right.
But yet, in this case, bond prices continue to rise, and they've been rising for 20 plus years. So what's going
right.
on? Why is there this dislocation?
So right. One of the things I believe, although I think it's very difficult to prove, let alone document, is that the growth of derivatives have given central bankers and the big banks interest rate swaps and other mechanisms they can use to really hold rates down. And if you look at the explosion of interest rate swaps during this period, you know, it's another question is, how do you keep that going?
That's a good point. You know, and I didn't even think about that. But in my mind, what I immediately ran to was what I'm showing here in chart 17.
Right.
And, you know, this to me is the explanation is for what's going on. And the fact is that those that are in control of the debt are monetizing it and thereby keeping control of the supply.
Right.
So instead of actually making it to the market where market forces and economics would work, the central banks are buying pretty much any and all of government bonds that are not being absorbed into the normal market. So doing so reduces supply. It creates an artificial demand, which in turn drives prices up and, of course, yields down. So to me,
right.
this is where the bulk of you know, what's going on and why.
One of the things to me that's most remarkable, if you look at the regulatory policies related to banks, there's tremendous pressure on the small banks to not loan and to basically invest back in treasuries. and what that is doing is it's cycling the money back to the government instead of the liquidity spilling out on Main Street in a way that would sort of kick up inflation and get that copper price going back up. So you see an explosion of liquidity, but it's not, you know, it's like water that is very carefully channeled in certain directions. It's not spilling everywhere.
Well, that in addition to the fact that the economy isn't quite as robust as it needs to be able for people to go out and borrow and take risks.
Right.
All right, let's take a look at chart number 18, because this is a look at where the U.S. roles and the U.S. Fed's role in the Treasury market is. So this chart zeroes in on the data here within the U.S., and it really helps reinforce the explanation about the central bank's balance sheet, to my mind. We can see that last year the Fed bought more than 80% of all government-issued debt, and it's on target for doing the same thing this year. And it's projected to be over 90% for next year. So
this is absolutely astonishing.
I mean, but why worry? We don't have what can possibly go wrong here, right? The one thing that we do have to worry about is what happens if, you know, yields should rise. What do we need to expect?
Well, I mean, if it keeps going this way and yields rise, then they're going to be financing 120% every year.
Until they can't, yeah. But
right.
Let's take a look at what happens if yields rise, because I think that this is where investors, in my mind, really aren't prepared. Or I hope that they are, but I'm throwing it on the table that because the bond market has been nothing but a bull for 20 plus years, that people aren't going to be prepared for this.
And let's just mention before we look at this, Chuck, what that means. What that means is, In 2008 or 2009, if I'm worried about the equity market being volatile or dropping, I can go to bonds. I can get out of stocks and I can go to bonds, and bonds are a safe place to be. But I think what we're saying is, you know, that's been fine as long as you've had that the yields trending down. If you're in a world that's different than that, that may not, you know, that old safe haven may not work or may not work as well. Okay, so let's go.
All right. So, you know, I think this study that Welton Investment Capital did is really good, because what they did was they put together a model to simulate various scenarios, and they're based on history, on what could happen today if bond prices, or excuse me, if interest rates rose. So the graphic that everybody sees right now provides five different scenarios and outcomes, and they got plenty of them, but I selected these five just, you know, for example. So the first column is the percentage that the rates rise in this example. The second is the length of time that the rates stay at that level. And those are based on, you know, historical averages. And the final column is the drawdown, or the change of the price of your bond. So while not all scenarios are bad, the average drawdown is a 24% loss, and that lasts for 36 months.
Mm.
So, you know, my thoughts immediately go to how many investors are ready for a 24% loss and for 3 years of being underwater on investment they viewed as safe.
Right. Well, in fact, in 2008, 2009, we saw some very high quality bond funds get clocked
yes.
by very significant percentages. So if they
50%.
Yeah. So if they experience that, then they know that it's the case. But I think generally they don't. We don't appreciate how much volatility we can experience in fixed income this time relative to equities. It's pretty significant. Yeah,
I agree. And that's my biggest concern. I just don't think that most investors yet are prepared. You know, I think they're willing to and able to deal with small losses. But if and when they turn to large ones, I just don't know how they're going to react.
Right. This could be very ugly.
Well, the other thing, it's not just investors. Think about, you know, those pension and the institutional money that's relying on that safety and stability, in those, you know, words are in quotes, that bonds provide for them in their portfolios. And, you know, could they really withstand a big loss for 3 years?
Well,
what kind of impact would that have on those that are relying on that pension money
right.
coming to them through retirement?
Right. And the bankruptcy of Stockton, California brings this up, and I'm going to talk about it at another time with the subscribers. But essentially, if we should get this kind of turn in the bond market, then suddenly the actuaries at all the state and local pension funds are going to inform the municipalities that they've got to significantly increase their contributions. And then you're talking about a real dynamic throughout the economy, which is going to be very profound.
Well, not only increase, but there's the other side of it, which might be that they can't, you know, meet that increased requirement, and therefore they got to cut off, you know, some of the money that they're providing.
Right.
They got to default on, not default in the whole, but default in the amount that they committed to paying
right.
retirees.
Right.
Well, you know, as a bottom line for me, you know, I don't think, you know, our society today in the United States or our financial model is set up that they could reasonably withstand one of these worst case scenarios. And I do think that this is something we really need to be, watching closely. And as you said, I think the bottom line for me is where, if and when that starts to happen, where's that money going to flow and what impact is that going to have into other areas? Because the bond market is so large that all it's going to take is a little trickling into commodities, into precious metals, into equities, wherever it happens to find a home, real estate.
Right.
And those markets are going to, you know, potentially take off like a rocket.
Can you give us a sense of relative size?
Yeah, and I'm go back to that chart. I'm trying to remember which one it is. I think it was the first chart in this section, which is chart number 10. So I'm just doing a ballpark
right.
estimate. So it's about one from a world global financial assets, it looks like equities make up about between 20 and 25% of the entire global assets.
Well, I'm looking at the Q2 2012. You've got $47 trillion in government bonds and $42 in financial sector bonds and $11 in corporate bonds. And then you've got the securitization. You know, you've got the mortgage and other securitized. So that's, let's see, 60, 70, 80, 90, about $170 trillion in fixed income versus 50 in equity.
Yeah, it totals it for you there, I believe.
Oh, it does?
Okay. Policy, it says financial, it says a percentage. So I think it's 50 over 312. No, 50 over 225 is what it works out.
Right. So it's four or five times
yes.
more debt than equity.
Yep.
And it doesn't take, but if only 20 to 25% moves over, you double the amount of equity.
Yes.
That's huge. Right.
Investors, I think, are going to need to be more careful about their fixed income choices.
Well, there are two things going on. One is, and let's go back. There are two things that can lower the value of a bond. One is a credit problem.
Yep.
So let's say I own a bond in New York City, a New York tax exempt in 1974, and then the city almost goes bankrupt, and the quality of my, you know, my rating can drop, or the perception of the quality of my credit can drop. Or if I have bond insurance and the bond insurance company goes belly up, which we saw in 2009, suddenly it's not a AAA anymore, it's something else. So the credit quality can deteriorate, and that can hurt my bond. But the second thing that can happen is interest rates can go up and the value of my bond go down. And there's a washback. Interest rates go up and suddenly issuers get more trouble, and so credit too. So there are two things to be concerned about, and both of them can have a dramatic impact on the value of your investment. So we're in an environment where we need to be a lot more picky about credit. And we also need to be cognizant that we can have the most wonderful credit in the world and the interest rates can still swing us one way or the other.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, there is, one might automatically think to say, well, maybe I can mitigate some of these risks by going into shorter maturities, which will impact or help impact the size of potential losses that one would take if we had a rise in interest rates.
Right.
But what you're giving up today is if you go to a short-term, you know, a two-year CD is going to get you 0.2%. So you're going to give up the, you know, for some safety and long-term price impact, you're going to give up yield.
Right. Although here's what I do have to say, you know, because a lot of times fixed income is a parking lot. If you look at the equity markets and they look as high as they are right now, you know, it's pretty easy to say, well, wait, I want to wait before I switch. And so staying in bonds certainly makes a lot of sense. And of course, in this environment, if you're conservative as you and I are, in all things balance. So, you know, you may be getting nothing by having money sit in a bank deposit, but it also is great to have cash if you get an extraordinary buying opportunity.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's, you know, that goes back to the methodology of, you know, buying low, selling high, or, you know, watching, or at least putting, you know, making sure that you have some dry powder as you get closer to what,
right.
like today where we are in the market at all-time highs.
Right.
You brought up some really good points that I thought we talked about, which were the impact to, or potential impact to cash.
What do you mean?
Well, you talked about, you know, if regulators happen to proceed with bank failures and without the too big to fail policy, uninsured bank deposits and bondholders could, you know, lose some or all of their value.
Right. We you know, just like we've enjoyed the dropping yields in the bond market, we've enjoyed both the positive and negative effects of the too big to bail policy. So when a large bank, we know that the financial sector has expanded far beyond what is healthy for the economy to enjoy in terms of financialization or just financial speculation. And so the regulators have been under orders from the time that Dodd-Frank passed on to say, you know, we want you to be able to resolve a bank failure or a troubled bank without too big to fail. And what does that mean? That means when that time comes, that bank is going to be put through a process, whether it's bankruptcy or something like bankruptcy, where the creditors and the bank depositors who are not insured are going to be written down or swapped into equity. And that's going to send a chill throughout the market because we, you know, we've been in too big to fail essentially since the mid-70s. And I think, you know, that will have ramifications running through all the different markets, whether it's bank deposits or money markets or short-term bonds. And, you know, when that happens, there's a chill that runs through the whole system. And the danger is that you seize up in liquidity. We saw, you know, we started to see that. And that's why Paulson was screaming we needed the bailouts, was the concern that the money markets would seize up in a bad way. And we have the SEC coming out shortly with new regulations on money markets, because I know one of the things they're grappling with is when they get ready to do this kind of too big to fail or not too big to fail kind of resolution, how are the money markets going to handle it? So we're coming into a world where the cash management is also, so not only are you going to have profound changes in the bond market and how it trades, there are going to be profound changes in the cash market and the short-term fixed income markets and how they trade. So you're right. Cash is going to look very different, I think, in the future than it has in the past, same as bonds. And, you know, if you add all the cash that's sitting, there's still remarkable amounts of money on the sideline. And if that money decides to shift into risk assets again, I'll never forget, and I've mentioned this before in the Solera report, during the Iceland crisis, a reporter was interviewing people coming out of the bank, and a woman said, a young woman was coming out, and she said, "What did you do?" And she said, "I took all my money out of the bank." And she said, "What are you going to do? What are you going to use it for?" And she said, "I'm going to pay down my mother's mortgage." And the reporter said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, you know, I know if things are really bad, my mom will be there for me. Who knows if the bank will be even exist?" And I said, "Well, people are remembering why we had such a thing as families and communities."
Yeah, it does kind of all fall back to that in the long run, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Well, you know, I mean, I think what we've done here has shown that both the potential increase in risk in both cash and in fixed income markets, you know, it does kind of make you look at those stable companies as quite attractive or potentially quite attractive alternative.
Right. Right.
And you know, the only problem is the volatility that's inherent in the equity markets that tends to make people shy away from it. But in the long run, you know, depending upon what happens and how it all plays out, you know, I think what we've done is laid out a potential scenario where fixed income could actually be more or as much volatile as equities. And so, you know, what's the advantage of the fixed income position or the cash position? Because, you know, equities at least give you some upside.
Right. And the way I feel is if you look across all the different asset categories, whether it's cash, whether it's fixed income, whether it's equities, whether it's commodities, all of them are, you know, we're going into an environment, Chuck, where we have a political model that has increased risk. And what that means is increased risk across the board. And so we're going to have to, you know, we've been spoiled and that, you know, we've been lucky and we've been spoiled, and now we're going to have to go into a new world where we're going to have to manage risk in a whole new and different way. And it is what it is.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. And we keep saying this, but I think it comes back to, you, no matter where you're going to go, you're not going to be able to avoid volatility. So it's going to be inherent in everything that we do, and it's you need to accept it, you know, and it's one of my best clients says, "You got to put on your big boy pants and deal with it."
I love that expression.
Yeah.
That's it for bonds, Chuck. Let's turn to stocks.
So I think I've presented some pretty decent arguments why one should be more concerned about holding bonds than they have in the past. Let's take a look at some of the tailwinds that are behind equities. So if we move to chart number 20, this is a look at the credit markets and the stock markets against GDP. I know you like this chart because it shows that the total equity market as a percentage of GDP is about one-third the size of the bond market. And, you know, from a stock investment standpoint, it clearly shows that the equity market is not flooded with an oversupply of stocks as we are in currently with bonds.
Right. Well, this chart, I find this chart very interesting, and it says several things to me. One is I'm concerned about the quality of corporate earnings and the extent to which it's dependent on more and more government borrowing, or for that matter, some of the corporate borrowing too. And so one of the things it makes me think about is which companies are not going to be hurt if that should change. But perhaps even a more important issue is, once that peak in fixed income changes, that's an awful lot of money in the fixed income market that's got to go someplace. And you would think it would go into equities. And I look at this and I think, okay, well, we have to have a planetary debt for equity swap. And of course, it goes back to, is this going to be nice or rough? But
Tina Turner again.
Yeah, Tina Turner. And but to me, this is one of the big questions. And this switch is one, you know, we can ride it as a, try and ride it like a surfboard or get drowned by it. But it's certainly something's going to change, and it's something we need to be prepared to manage.
Agreed. All right, let's take a look at the next chart, which is foreign ownership of U.S. stocks. So in the prior discussion above, I talked about how households outside the United States have very light equity exposure as compared to here in the U.S. And but what you can see is that the dark blue line on this chart shows that the actual increase in foreign ownership in U.S. companies is rising, and rising at a pretty good clip. Except if you notice that one little dip there back in, I think it's the 90s there, the early 90s.
Right.
And but since then, it's been growing at a really nice clip.
It's remarkable because this growth tracks very much the process of globalization we've been going through. So we see the Uruguay round of GATT pass in the early 90s, and then the WTO get created, and globalization really take off with much money shifting out of the United States, so U.S. investors shifting it abroad and foreign investors shifting back in. And to me, you're talking about something as this money shifts in that can have profound changes in the way companies and the way politics are managed, because remember, we're talking about institutions that now need to be responsive to a much more globalized constituency than before, whether it's customers or shareholders. So globalization is happening, and to me, this trend is just going to continue.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's why I love talking to you, because I didn't even think about that, but that's I think probably a huge reason for the reason of we're seeing such large growth.
Right, and we saw the same dynamic happen earlier in the bond market, because you saw American politicians suddenly becoming much more sensitive to the creditors who were globalizing. And, it's all part of this process.
Interesting. Okay, let's jump right into chart 22, which is the shrinking supply of United States stocks.
This is shocking. This chart was shocking to me.
Yeah, me too, because I've been telling everybody for years that, there are, somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 stocks available on the U.S. stock markets you can invest in, when in fact, I've been wrong. I didn't realize this. And so, it was a shock. It really shows that since 2000, we've been at a pretty decent clip in reducing the number of stocks available on the markets. And of course, some of this could be explained by the 2000 and 2008 stock bubbles. But because, a lot of those companies went out of business. But the fact is that we're almost on a pace of a 40% drop over the last 12 years.
Well, I think part of it is when interest rates are coming down the way they have, it makes tremendous economic sense for companies to borrow money and use that money to buy other companies or buy in their equities. And so to me, mergers and acquisitions explain some of it, including companies taking themselves private. So we see Michael Dell trying to take his company private and so they leave the exchange. So part of this is falling interest rates. And of course, if that changes, then you've got companies who've got every reason to want to finance with equity or go into the markets, do IPOs, because equity suddenly becomes a lot more attractive as a way to finance than debt.
Yeah, well, either way, for whatever the reason may be, we know that it creates a real positive tailwind for equities because as the supply of something shrinks, the prices
right.
follow along in the upward direction.
Right, and I think this is one of the reasons why there's been such a push to get the Jobs Act passed and permit crowdfunding to happen for entrepreneurs and sort of early venture capital. I talked on the first quarter wrap-up about, and last week I just posted something on the blog 2 weeks ago about they estimate crowdfunding volumes to double next year, coming from mostly instead of being social projects, coming from equity, early equity investments. So my guess is it's to help kickstart and help reverse this process.
Interesting. Well, that definitely is. There's a lot of buzz around that sector of the market, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I'm always saying to the subscribers, beware, beware,
yeah.
Beware.
Exactly, especially in an early phase of these things.
Yeah,
one has to be most fearful. Okay, let's jump right into chart 23, which is equity market dividend yields.
Okay,
so. In a world where 10-year sovereign debt yields somewhere around 2%, those investors that are hungry for yield will find this chart, I think, compelling as it shows worldwide equity yields at a very favorable level as compared to fixed income alternatives. So, but in addition not only to the competitive yields, in my mind, there's way more upside potential with stocks, whereas with bonds at current prices today, I think the probability of them being able to eke out any upside is really low.
Right. So the chance of a dramatic decrease in yields in the bond market is very, very small. and so you don't see how the income that you're getting from bonds can compare. Now, this is why, this chart absolutely underscores the importance of the analysis you showed us earlier about the potential volatility on bonds, because traditionally, as we've been going through this dropping yield environment, we've gone to bonds for safety of principal amounts. But if that could change, if and when the turn comes, and as you've pointed out, the turn isn't here yet, but if and when that turn comes, then the volatility on bonds could be as great, if not greater, than on equities.
Absolutely. So what's the advantage then?
Right. I mean, why not just have something? If you're going to have equal amounts of volatility, then why not have some growth potential?
Well, in addition to maybe potentially greater yields too.
Right. Right.
All right. Let's close out this thing and look at the final chart that I've got up here for this is a study that was done, and it looks at projected future returns around the world. So this is a study done by the folks at Guru Focus. What they did was they put together a model in an attempt to estimate annualized stock returns for various countries around the world for the next 10 years. And if you're interested in seeing more details on the study, you can go to their website, and it's www.gurufocus.com. And, the thing is that the methodologies and the variables that they used are similar, but not exactly to the others who have used models to predict stock future returns. And some people that I follow that do the exact same thing are Doug Short, John Hussman, and Gary Schilling. But what I want people to take away from this is not the specific projected returns. Don't look at China here and say that, okay, this study says I'm going to get 30% return for the next 10 years. That's not really what you should take from this. What you really want to grasp is that where that market, where those markets, those positive markets, where those returns are going to come from. And
right.
Clearly from the results, you know, you can see that the emerging markets provide the best opportunity for returns going forward. And that just brings us right back around to your and my thesis of, you know, successful investing, you know, that lay within the focus of things that are in a primary trend.
Right. So what we're saying is, you know, the first quarter said fundamentals don't matter, but what we're saying is in the long run, yes, fundamentals do matter.
Exactly.
They do. And clearly the three primary trends you hear Chuck and I talk about on the equity overviews is one is the emerging markets, two is technology and innovation, and three is the, you know, it's tangibles in the sense that we have more people and the same amount of land and stuff, and the pressure of a growing and globalizing population puts on that. So, but clearly emerging markets is one of the primary trends, and it's one that's very, very long-lived.
Yep.
Okay, well, Chuck, this has been an extraordinary presentation. I know that this represents years of work and analysis on your part, and you've been very generous with sharing it with you, and I really appreciate. So just to turn to the closing, I want to stress again the big question. And I think the big question is we've been in one paradigm, and that paradigm has really been driven by a very long-term bull market in the bonds. And that's got to change. We know it can't continue. You know, we can't keep falling into negative interest rates and stay there. And so the question is, how are we going to, you know, how and when are we going to turn? And where is all this money that's piled up in the fixed income markets going to go? And of course, very big question, is it going to go to equities? And we don't know the answers to these questions, but what it says is there's potential for great change. And what that says is this is time to pay attention and to understand that a lot of what we take for granted is not a natural law. It's a condition created by this long-term bull market in bonds, and we need to start being prepared to change our assumptions of how things are going to work.
Yep.
I'm glad you agree.
Well, I couldn't say anything. I mean, that just wraps it up, I think, perfectly.
Okay, well, the big, you know, the thing I always wonder about is if I'm listening to this, if I'm a Solari Report subscriber, what's my takeaway? And I think, you know, everybody's different. Their asset positions are different. Their needs are different. Their situation is different. I'm loath to give generic rules. But the one thing I would say is when you're coming into a period with this much potential change, that in one sense, the risk levels are rising across the board in all asset categories. And now is a time to go to quality. You want to have quality in the companies that you invest in. You want to have quality in the issuers that you're investing in. You want to have great governance and management. You know, when the world rocks and rolls, and this is really a rock and roll kind of situation, you know, quality leadership counts for a lot. It's the leadership that can take advantage of change and can, you know, manage the risk even when the going gets tough. So I would say go to quality, and the last thing is it's also a time to have quality in your custodian. You know, we have financial institutions that are engaged in a lot of speculation and are stretched, and are in very volatile assets like derivatives, and now is a time to have custodians who I think see their business as serving you as opposed to engaging in the speculation, so you can't be too careful in terms of quality. So I would say go to quality. And then the second thing I would say is, you know, pay attention, because there are things we didn't have to pay attention to in the past that we're going to have to pay attention to now. And as you say, now is not the time to take on additional risk.
Yeah, not only, I think, take on additional risk, you know, not trying to give specific advice, but, you know, it's not the time to take on additional risk. I don't think it's the time to chase yield with your bond position. And it's not time to try and eke out that return, you know, that look for performance. Try and pick up pennies in front of a steamroller. There is just, you know, we haven't fixed any of the risks that were there in 2008 and 2009. And all we've done is add to them. So while the markets can be, you know, ridiculously out of, you know, positive for 3 years or 4 years since then, at some point in time we go back to the reversion to the mean, or some point in time the risks are going to take over and people are going to be very, very concerned. So, you know, the one key word from here for me is balance.
Right. Balance.
Balance.
Well, Chuck, thank you very much. We're going to be back with you in a quarter for the third quarter, and I am sure we'll have a lot to talk about as well.
Thank you, Catherine. It was great being with you, and I look forward to next quarter.
Have a great day.
You too.